From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, dozens are killed in Nigerian capital bomb blast. Libya's interim prime minister quits. Is history repeating itself in Egypt?
Here we are again seeing someone from the military who has the support of the military being pretty much the presumptive next president.
And the UN Security Council holds an emergency meeting on Ukraine. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Police in Nigeria say at least 71 people died when a bomb went off at a bus station in the suburbs of the capital Abuja today. As Heather Murdoch reports, some analysts say the latest attack is a sign that Islamist insurgents in Nigeria have expanded their reach.
Shortly before 7 a.m. Monday morning, taxi driver Joseph Suleiman was driving into the city for work. He was about a half a kilometer from Nyanya Motor Park when the bomb exploded.
We were inside the car. We heard the bomb blast, and my car was shaking. Everybody, we were totally confused.
They were confused, he says, because there hasn't been an attack in the Nigerian capital in 2 years, when Boko Haram blew up a prominent media house, killing several people. In 2011, more than 60 people were killed in other attacks that targeted the local UN headquarters and a church. Suleiman says he saw scores of badly injured people as he passed the bus depot.
People told us that it was the Boko Haram that put the bomb inside the Aerofire car that exploded, that killed many lives. But actually, it is only God that knows the truth.
Some officials say despite nearly a year of emergency rule in three northeastern Nigerian states, the Boko Haram insurgency is growing. This is Member of Parliament Herman Hembe.
We've allocated huge sums for particularly security in this country, and I don't see any improvements. It's just been getting worse.
Boko Haram has been blamed for thousands of deaths since the insurgency began in 2009. Amnesty International says 1,500 people have been killed in attacks this year alone, and about a half a million people have fled their homes. Boko Haram says it wants to enforce its harsh version of Islamic law and destroy the government, but many analysts blame the unrest partially on extreme poverty, saying unemployment drives young men to fight for small sums of money. However, Pastor Ayo Oritsejiofor, the president of the Christian Association of Nigeria, says the insurgency is a result of religious extremism.
It's about ideology, it's not poverty. It's not marginalization. Yes, it is true that when you deal with poverty, you may reduce the number of recruits, people that they can recruit.
Attacking the ideology through education and the religious leadership in Nigeria's mostly Muslim northern states is the only way to end the insurgency, he says. The Nigerian military maintains that it has beaten back Boko Haram and reclaimed many areas formerly held by insurgents. The military says a jailbreak last month where hundreds of fleeing detainees were killed was an attempt by Boko Haram to replenish its depleted ranks. Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the jailbreak and threatened more violence. The group has not claimed responsibility for this latest attack, but typically Boko Haram communicates with the public through video messages, which can take days or weeks to release. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Libya's interim prime minister, Abdullah Althani, who was held the post for less than 3 weeks, has excused himself from forming a new government after he and his family came under attack at their home on Saturday. Edward Uranian reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Libyan interim prime minister, Abdullah Althani, announced Sunday that he is effectively giving up his post, adding an extra level of uncertainty to an already unsettled political situation. Mr. Thani said in a statement on the government's website that he would not head the next cabinet, but would stay on in a caretaker capacity until the new government is in place. He said he made the move to protect the interests of the country and avoid dragging different sides into a conflict in which everyone would lose. Government spokesman Ahmed Al-Amin indicated that Mr. Thani was not stepping down immediately, but an attack on his family had prompted him to seek a successor.
ولكن قدم اعتذاره عن قبول التكليف بتشكيل الحكومة الجديدة.
He says Mr. Thni has not resigned but has excused himself from forming the new government. The prime minister and his family, he added, came under attack by a group of armed militiamen at their home late Saturday.
إننا نسجل استنكارنا التام لهذه التصرفات والتي لا يمكن أن نعتبرها إلا تصرفات إجرامية مخالفة للقانون.
Tripoli City Council head Sadat al-Badri condemned the attack against the interim prime minister, calling it a desperate attempt to destabilize the country. He also demanded armed militias evacuate Libyan cities and return them to the people. Former Prime Minister Ali Zeidan, who was given a vote of no confidence on March 11th, was briefly kidnapped by militiamen earlier this year. The Carinthia Hotel, which has served as a residence for various government officials, also came under attack several times. University of Tripoli political science professor Ahmed Al-Atrash tells VOA that he is not expecting any major political disruption from Mr. Thani's stepping down.
A minister from the same cabinet may continue until the election for the next 3-4 months. Taking into account the agreement among the council members and the interim government.
He added that the Libyan public is expecting fresh elections for a new parliament in the months to come, so the current state of change will be taken in stride by most people. Meanwhile, the trial of former leader Muammar Gaddafi's two sons and several former prime ministers got underway briefly in the capital, Tripoli, but was quickly adjourned until April 27th. Investigators say they need more time to finish their cases. Neither of Gaddafi's sons was present at the trial session. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
It has been 3 years since the Arab Spring Revolt ended the 30-year rule of Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak. It has now been 1 year since Muslim Brotherhood, backed and elected leader Mohamed Morsi, was ousted from office. Egypt is now more divided and looks to Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the general who carried out last July's coup after protests against Morsi. Al-Sisi has since resigned from the military to run for president in May. Is history repeating itself? Kim Lewis posed this question to VOA Cairo Bureau Chief Elizabeth Arrett.
There is certainly a sense of that at 3 years after a popular uprising that got rid of a military-backed president and someone who came from the military, here we are again seeing someone from the military who has the support of the military being pretty much the presumptive next president. He will be running in the election, the former field marshal, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and he doesn't really have any strong competition. There's a lot of, A, he's very popular, and B, the government has clamped down really on any opposition. So there is that sense of coming full circle.
Do you think Sisi is the one who will be able to measure up to these daunting challenges that are placed before him? Egypt has never been more divided than it is right now.
Well, certainly it doesn't appear so at the moment. And Sisi, and when we say Sisi, the government and the military behind him, he's sort of a catch-all for the powers that be. They are working very hard to break down the Muslim Brotherhood. There are thousands of members in prison. At least 1,000 have been killed since the ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi last year, and all their media has been shut down. The rest of the media is very much pro the government. They very much demonize the opposition. And it's not just the Muslim Brotherhood. Some of the original, more secular, liberal activists who brought about the revolution 3 years ago, they're now facing jail. Foreign journalists, as well as many Egyptian journalists, are in jail. It's very, very hard now to see a way out of this polarization, especially as it is largely coming from the government and its acts against anybody in the opposition, to see him turning around, at least in the immediate future, and trying to bring all these people in, especially, again, the Muslim Brotherhood is declared a terrorist organization, and it's hard to step away from those kinds of steps, and it would take quite a while, I think, before we start to see any kind of reconciliation process.
Also, do you think Egyptian officials are looking at the situation and saying that, yes, this country does need an overhaul of religious and political institutions? It's just a matter of time before we can get to that point of actually implementing this?
Well, that's a good point about time. There are so many more immediate problems. One of them is just security, because in addition to today's Friday, there are a lot of Muslim Brotherhood and other protests. It's a traditional day of protests. Those are going on. They can be very disruptive, and then they can start to get clashes for police that sort of destabilizes things. You have a true militant insurgency coming from Sinai. It was based in Sinai, but is moving closer into mainland Egypt. On top of that, you have near daily protests from students at the university campuses. You have workers' strikes. And that actually, the economic situation could be one of the most, on top of political, maybe even more of a challenge to whoever runs the next government. We're seeing electricity outages many times every day. It's very, very dire economic situation, and that could be the biggest challenge, I think, to the next government.
And you just touched on something that I was going to bring up, and that is the youth movement there, if you can call it a youth movement. The protesters are primarily students, young people. So do you think that they will likely explode again if Sisi and his future government fail to create jobs?
Well, it certainly is very much a big question. Now, a lot of these daily protests in the university tend to be more supporters of ousted President Morsi, but certainly because of the oppression also of other, those original Tahrir Square activists, it'll be interesting to see how as they move forward. And this is the critical difference between now and 3 years ago, that people are mobilized, they feel empowered, even with the sort of heavy-handed tactics that ban protests. We're still seeing them. People are still coming out. And this is a big bulge. It's a very youth-oriented society. And with the unemployment, I think that is, there have been vague talks about sort of making jobs, but we have not seen that translate. And that could certainly lead to further unrest.
VOA Middle East Bureau Chief Elizabeth Arad in Cairo.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The UN Security Council met late Sunday in emergency session at Russia's request, hours before a deadline imposed by Ukraine's interim leadership on pro-Russian protesters who occupy state buildings to disarm or face a full-scale anti-terrorist operation. Sunday, Ukrainian special forces and pro-Russian militia exchanged gunfire in the eastern city of Slovyansk, with both sides reporting casualties. Saturday, pro-Russian gunmen took over the city's police station and government facilities in the largely ethnic Russian cities of Donetsk and Kramatorsk. Russian UN Ambassador Vitaly Churkin, speaking through an interpreter, insisted Ukrainian national radicals are to blame for the current crisis.
We have pointed out on several occasions, including in this chamber, that the evil actions leading to the coup de force by the self-proclaimed Kiev authorities are threatening once and for all to tear the fragile fabric of the mosaic-based society. The authorities do not want to listen to those who do not accept the imposed dominance in Kiev of national radicals and chauvinist, Russophobian, anti-Semitic forces, seeing in them a threat to their human dignity and to their very lives.
He called on the council to ask Kiev to stop the use of force against eastern Ukrainian people. Ambassador Churkin's Ukrainian counterpart, Yuri Sergeyev, said recent videos posted online clearly show Russian interference in his country.
These videos leave absolutely no doubts that the terrorist groups are not the peaceful protesters, as our Russian colleagues are trying to represent it, but obviously the professional special forces appropriately equipped and armed as such of Russian Federation. Terrorists started using their weapons against Ukrainian law enforcement and military officers. Russia often positions itself as a prominent fighter against international terrorism. But by sending its special agents to Ukraine for diversions and sabotage, it is actually sponsoring terrorism.
U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power accused Moscow of backing the pro-separatist sentiment.
These armed units, some wearing black and orange St. George's ribbons associated with Russian Victory Day celebrations, raised Russian and separatist flags over seized buildings, and have called for referendums and union with Russia. We know who is behind this, indeed the only entity in the area capable of these coordinated professional military actions is Russia.
She announced that the United States will conclude a $1 billion loan guarantee for Ukraine. Britain's UN diplomat Mark Lael Grant told the council Russia has massed tens of thousands of troops near the Ukrainian border, in addition to the 25,000 troops it moved into Crimea, which Moscow seized last month.
Russia is seeking to impose its will on the people of Ukraine using misinformation, intimidation, and aggression, tactics drawn from the darkest days of the last century. This is completely unacceptable. The Ukrainian people have the right to determine their own future free from Russian interference.
Jonathan Adelman, associate professor at the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Russians hope to replicate their annexation of Crimea and have a tremendous military advantage.
The Russians spend $90 billion a year on their military, and the Ukrainians spend less than $2 billion. The Russians have 700,000 combat troops, and the Ukrainians have 90,000. And NATO has very little. So I think right now they're not intending to invade, but the Russians are using the same tactics that they used in Crimea. And so I think it's something that we need to react strongly and make clear that there really are very serious consequences, because I think they're misreading what happened in Crimea. They had an easy victory in Crimea, and the West talks a lot, but really didn't do very much. And I think the time is for a little more action to make sure the Russians understand more clearly the implications here. They may still be okay if we don't, but I think it'd be very good if we did.
Well, the U.S. U.N. ambassador on television Sunday said the United States is preparing to step up sanctions against Moscow if pro-Russian military actions in eastern Ukraine continue. The next round of sanctions expected to target business sectors such as mining, banking, and energy. But U.S. officials said it was uncertain Europe would go along with penalties that would affect Russia's economy and energy sector. Is this too little, too late?
I'm not sure it's too late, but it's certainly too little. And we need to work with our European allies. We need to recognize that over 30% of all the gas that they import comes from Russia, and that some of the countries, led by Germany, which is the strongest country in the EU by far, are very reluctant to go very far with this because of their history in World War II. And Russia is near and America is far. And although the Germans want to be on very good terms with the United States, they also, for example, in the 1990s, when the United States banks lent only a couple billion dollars to the Russians under Boris Yeltsin, the German banks, smaller than American banks, lent $20 billion. So I think we need to get coordinated with the Europeans, because the other problem we have is militarily, the United States had 400,000 troops in Europe in 1990. Today, we have 85% less. We have 65,000 troops. And in some of the countries, like in Poland, we have exactly 10 fighter airplanes. Now, we're not going to war, but I think it's important that the Russians understand, not just here, is what I'd like to emphasize. It's not just Ukraine. There's a lot of other places. When the Cold War ended in 1991, there were between 25 and 30 million Russians outside of Russia, because it didn't matter in those days. It was all Soviet Union. So we need to develop a coordinated policy here. And the problem is the Russians, the message they're getting is they're looking at Syria, no American intervention. They're looking at Egypt, buying weapons from the Russians. They're looking at Shinzo Abe from Japan, sitting next to Vladimir Putin. And even Viktor Orban in Hungary now is talking to the Russians. So I think we need a more active foreign policy, and it must be coordinated with our European allies, or it's just not going to be credible. Do I think they're going to invade? I don't think so. But I think what they're going to do is try the same tactics. They're already doing it. You know, get the pro-Russian forces, have them seize areas, hopefully near the border, and then send people in. It's a kind of non-invasion invasion, which worked for them in Crimea, and they're sort of trying to see if that might work again.
Top diplomats from Russia, the United States, Ukraine, and the European Union are set to hold emergency talks on the crisis Thursday in Geneva. White House officials say U.S. Vice President Joe Biden will travel to Kiev April 22nd. Amid the pro-Russian uprisings in eastern Ukraine, there is a large body of activists who support Ukrainian unity and reject Russian intervention. Their activities have remained largely underground, but they are preparing to take on their pro-Moscow opponents, as Henry Ridgewell reports from the eastern city of Donetsk.
Россия! Россия!
In the middle of a pro-Russian crowd gathered in Donetsk, Kolya, a young man barely out of his teens, is trying to go unnoticed. It is not easy. He is holding up a digital camera that's live-streaming the event to a pro-Ukrainian website so that fellow anti-Russian activists can monitor what is happening. Kolya manages to infiltrate inside the barricades. It is a dangerous game, but he emerges unscathed. Later, Kolya demonstrates the radio app on the same device that like-minded activists use to coordinate their actions.
This speaker about how to find guys who want to be in Ukraine, defend Donetsk region from Russian occupation.
In Donetsk, Orthodox priests are putting themselves on the front line. On a central intersection below monuments bearing old Soviet emblems, they fly the blue and yellow Ukrainian colors and hold hourly prayers for national unity. In a city elsewhere adorned with Russian insignia, it is a brave stance. Pietro Matyshenko, a priest from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Kiev Patriarchy, says they are in constant danger. At first, we began praying in the central Lenin Square in Donetsk, but we were attacked with bats and stones, he says. Still, people are aggressive and evil, and they come here to try to destroy the tent. Inside a cafe overlooking the intersection, pro-unity activists gather to watch over the priest's tent. In hushed tones, they plot how to respond to the pro-Russian uprisings. Sergei Yeryomin is head of the council of the self-proclaimed Donetsk Self-Defense Force. What could happen is a full civil war with a resistance movement, Yeryomin says. People would not stay silent to Russian intervention. They would have problems here. It would not be like in Crimea. Pro-unity demonstrators are trying to counter their pro-Russian opponents. Hundreds turned out for a rally in Donetsk Saturday, linking hands along one of the main roads in a sign of unity linking East and West, an act repeated in cities across the country.
Ми за воссоединение України, всі України, схід разом, щоб ви були всі в місті. Я хочу, щоб наша Україна...
East and West are together, says this woman. I want Ukraine to be free and independent. We Ukrainians are all brothers. In Donetsk, there are plenty who would disagree. So far, the two sides have stayed apart. Both are preparing for conflict. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Donetsk.
Hi, I'm David Byrne.
And I'm Ling Yang.
I'm Aisha Khalid.
And I'm Madeline Eck.
We're the hosts of VOA's Now.
We'll be bringing you stories that interest you.
Join the conversation
every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
Beginning April 28th for the Voice of America's Now.
American golfer Bubba Watson has won the Masters for the second time in 3 years. Watson claimed the prestigious green jacket that goes to the champion of golf's first major tournament each year by shooting a final round, 3 under par 69 on Sunday. That gave him a four-round total of 8 under par 280 and a three-stroke victory over countryman Jordan Spieth and Sweden's Jonas Blixt. A 20-year-old Spieth was bidding to become the youngest ever champion at the Augusta National Club in the southeastern U.S. state of Georgia. He was tied with the 35-year-old Watson to start the fourth and final round and led by 2 shots after 7 holes. But then the tournament swung in Watson's favor. He grabbed the lead after 9 holes and stayed in front the rest of the way to win the first prize of $1.62 million. Finishing alone in fourth place was 50-year-old Spaniard Miguel Angel Jimenez. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.